Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Coal miners in coal country are celebrating the Trump administration's rollback of environmental regulations.
Since Donald Trump has elected a president, coal mining has picked up and he made his promise and he's keeping it.
But economists warn that even with these new policies, coal's long-term future in Appalachia doesn't look so great. Meanwhile, politicians in the United Kingdom recently announced plans to stop burning coal for electricity by 2025. We'll hear how people in Great Britain are reacting to their war on coal.
It cannot be satisfactory for an advanced economy like the UK to be relying on polluting, carbon-intensive, 50-year-old coal-fired power stations.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Coal miners and their families in Appalachia take great pride in their work and the brotherhood that surrounds coal mining.
Once you get used to it, I wouldn't do nothing else. I mean, it's just, it's a culture. I mean, it's, you know, brotherhood.
That's Jeremy Brock, a Kentucky coal miner. His interview was recorded back in 2016 as part of a photography project called Humans of Central Appalachia. He lost his job in Kentucky and eventually relocated to Alabama in search of work. There are so many stories like his. And I think it's important to remember that as we talk about coal, for many people in my neck of the woods, we're not only talking about jobs or the ability to earn a good living right out of high school. We're also talking about identity and culture. Today, we're revisiting a show that first aired last fall. Some of the news coming out of Washington is being celebrated by coal miners in coal country, so we'll look at how the coal industry in Great Britain compares with our own. We'll hear voices from England, Scotland, and Wales. And we'll hear music that traveled across the ocean from the United Kingdom to the hills of Appalachia.
I had moved from Scotland over to North Carolina, very quickly realized I was in the heartland of some fantastic music.
That interview with Fiona Ritchie, host of Thistle and Shamrock, is up ahead in the second half of our show. But first, let's begin in Charleston, West Virginia, where President Trump recently held a rally, in part to celebrate the rollback of environmental regulations on the coal industry. Trump hailed his administration's new affordable clean energy rule as something that will fuel a coal comeback. The rule replaces an Obama-era regulation intended to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. But as Brittany Patterson reports, industry experts say they don't expect Trump's new plan to change coal's future in the Ohio Valley, and the administration's own analysis agrees.
When Trump wants to talk coal, he comes to West Virginia. So it was not surprising that the president visited Charleston just hours after his administration unveiled a long-awaited overhaul of the Clean Power Plan.
Every day we're keeping our promises. We're canceling Obama's illegal, anti-coal-destroying regulations, the so-called Clean Power Plan.
The replacement is called the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, and it puts the onus on states to decide how to reduce emissions from coal-fired power plants. Replacing the Clean Power Plan marks perhaps the largest effort yet that the Trump administration has undertaken in its quest to end the so-called war on coal. It has also rewritten parts of a federal rule on coal ash, and it's working on a plan to help struggling coal plants. And now, it's replaced the rules on carbon emissions.
Oh, it will help. There's no question about it.
Chris Hamilton is with the West Virginia Coal Association.
We're hopeful, and we don't see any reason that would, that would serve as a barrier to, investment.
But many analysts and experts disagree. Brian Lego is with West Virginia University's Bureau of Business and Economic Research. It's his job to make sense of all of the coal numbers released by the government.
It won't change the overall trajectory.
Lego says the coal industry's number one problem is not regulations, but natural gas, specifically low natural gas prices.
In terms of the competitiveness of coal compared to natural gas over the longer term, that's something that would require much a much more significant change in the policy rules.
Then there's the fact that mining in Appalachia has been ongoing for generations. The easy-to-get seams have been mined, which means it costs more to extract coal here. Trevor Hauser is a partner at the independent research company Rhodium Group.
Appalachian coal is also relatively high cost, thermal coal anyway, compared to Powder River Basin coal, where I grew up in Wyoming, or even interior coal from Illinois. And so the market for coal is shrinking, and Appalachia is a relatively high-cost producer.
The EPA seems to understand this. The agency's own analysis of the impacts of the Affordable Clean Energy Rule forecasts declining coal production across the country. Appalachia would lose at least 78% of its mining by 2035, according to the EPA. The agency also finds the new rule could pose a significant cost to human health. Under the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, older, dirtier power plants will likely be able to run longer. EPA estimates as many as 1,400 people each year could die prematurely of heart and lung disease due to soot from smokestacks. Bill Price is with the Sierra Club. He says expect cases of asthma and other respiratory diseases to go up.
Air quality will decrease. And not improve as we would have under the Clean Power Plan.
The new proposal is expected to still reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But instead of shifting the whole power sector toward cleaner fuel sources, it would require states to work with utilities to make their plants more efficient. WVU law professor James Van Ostrin says those upgrades will not help coal's competitiveness.
Because at the end of the day, they've got to be able to sell their power into very competitive wholesale markets, and it's all a matter of economics, and if this doesn't improve the economics, it's not really going to make much of a difference in terms of improving the prospects for the coal industry.
While many utilities welcomed the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, they don't appear to be rethinking their plans for coal-fired power. Both Dominion Energy and American Electric Power say they are sticking with their current plans to reduce emissions and pursue renewable energy. Three coal-fired power plants, two in Kentucky and one in West Virginia, are still slated to close by 2020. Still, Trump's message that he is coal's champion resonated with many who attended his recent rally in West Virginia. Kentucky coal miner Jonathan Crum said he was excited the president emphasized coal. After hearing Trump speak, Crum hit the road to Logan County, West Virginia, where he works for a mine repair and maintenance company.
Since Donald Trump has elected a president, coal mining has picked up, and he made his promise, and he's keeping it and continue to make coal good and America great again.
Coal production and jobs have been doing better in West Virginia. Since the middle of 2016, strong export demand for steel coal has driven coal production up by about 27% and added about 2,000 jobs. But other parts of the Ohio Valley have seen little change in coal employment. Lego, the economist at WVU, says this upswing is expected to stabilize.
We're going to see some tapering of some moderation in export demand over the next couple of years.
And over the next two decades, the models still predict coal production is expected to sharply decline. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
Brittany's reporting on the energy industry is part of a collaboration between the Ohio Valley Resource and West Virginia Public Broadcasting and is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The war on coal argument was a big part of Trump's presidential campaign, and it continues to be a theme of his presidency. President Trump, certain lobbying groups, and many coal miners want to keep these jobs. But one country is dealing with the industry's future in a radically different way. Next, we'll journey across the ocean to the United Kingdom. PRI's The World recently aired a two-part series about what happened there when the government decided to shut down coal mines and coal-fired power plants as part of an effort to reduce greenhouse gases. Reporter Carolyn Beeler has been digging into the story of coal in the United Kingdom and why things are so different there than they are in the U.S. Here's part one in her two-part series.
Yorkshire has been called England's Texas, but without the sun and guns. It's an energy powerhouse where farms and villages sit on top of vast coal fields. Today, a vintage engine still lowers a cage elevator into a mine that opened in the 1700s. But it's not miners going underground anymore.
Kids, listen to me!
It's kids visiting the National Coal Mining Museum, which opened after the mine closed in the 80s.
Say bye-bye!
Sean McLaughlin is showing me around the old mine, including its stables.
We keep the ponies here. Morning, Ellison.
Morning.
These will be used to pull the tubs of coal underground. Come on.
McLaughlin has neatly trimmed gray hair and an impish grin. He grew up in public housing in a nearby village. His dad and grandfather were miners, and he became one at age 16.
When people went to the local schools, it was sort of taken that unless they went on to university, they would just move into coal mining, basically.
McLaughlin got college paid for, and he was on the management track. But early on, he put in his time in the dark, hot pits.
The humidity was over 90%, so it was really, really arduous, and with the dust and the heat, so yeah, it takes a toll on the body.
The work was hard, but the camaraderie that was built underground rose up to the surface. The mine where McLaughlin started out had its own social club and even brass band. Now, McLaughlin is almost in awe of the fact that the kids who come to the museum have no connection to coal.
There's children now growing up that don't know what coal is. Once they stop burning coal, they'll not realise that coal fueled the Industrial Revolution of Great Britain and put us where we are on the map.
It's almost impossible to overstate the importance of coal to the UK. The first successful steam engine was invented to pump water out of British coal mines. Coal heated the country's homes. It powered the railroads and ships and factories that built Britain's empire. It helped the country survive two world wars. And at its height, more than a million people worked in coal mining. That number began to fall in the 1920s with mechanization and declining demand for coal. But those job losses stopped for a while in the 1970s when the oil crisis hit the UK. Things were looking up again for King Coal.
When I started in the industry, I was told, you've got a job for life. You've got a job for life, lad, as they say around these parts.
I talked to David Murray one night at his local pub. The mines had been nationalised after World War II, and jobs there felt safe for a while.
Things started to change in the early 80s.
Murray remembers it well. It was 1984, and the government-backed Coal Board announced plans to close some inefficient mines.
1984, and a war of attrition engulfs the British coal industry.
Most of the country's miners staged a bitter strike to protest the move.
And it was a defining, deeply scarring moment in the history of British industrial relations.
Sean McLaughlin took me to the mine where he was working at the time.
Hiya, mate. Listen, I'm just at gate with a reporter from BBC World Service.
In 1984, this spot, just outside the gate, was chaos.
The road would be totally blocked.
There were at least 6,000 miners, perhaps many more.
There were thousands of pickets.
Facing them were 700 policemen in full riot gear.
There would be the police there with the horses and the dogs trying to clear the road.
There was an atmosphere of real tension.
Miners threw bricks and punches. Cops put miners in headlocks and dragged them, kicking and screaming from the front lines. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher had run on a platform of busting up union power, and she waged a PR war against the picketers.
Mr. Chairman, what we have seen in the past few weeks is not picketing at all. It is intimidation. It is unlawful assembly.
Yeah. All the publicity on TV was showing the miners as being basically thugs. So there's a lot of bad feeling towards the miners.
The country, watching this all on TV, was bitterly divided. Some supported the police, others backed the miners.
It split families, it split brothers.
Some miners crossed the picket line to go back to work. McLaughlin didn't.
Obviously, with being a third-generation miner, you knew that it was a sin to break the strike and what they call scab. I ended up on strike for 12 months. I'd been married a couple of years. Life was really tough.
Union leaders gambled that the country couldn't keep the lights on without coal. But the lights stayed on, and the violence had turned public opinion against the miners. After a year, they admitted defeat and went back to work.
And the government was free then to carry out the pit closure program at an accelerated rate.
Now, none of this had anything to do with the harmful effects of burning coal. Climate change wasn't really on anyone's radar at the time. It was all about economics and political power. The UK was actually still burning a lot of coal. It was often just cheaper to import it than dig it up at home. But the failed strike meant that the number of miners in the UK plummeted from 139,000 in 1984 to just 7,000 a decade later. And the miners' influence in London collapsed as well. Former miner David Murray says the strike changed everything.
There was a sense before the strike of the industry being so important, and I just think the industry lost that importance politically, economically, and everything.
And that loss of influence would end up paving the way for another big shift for coal here, one that almost nobody saw coming in the 1980s.
My government will publish a bill on climate change as part of its policy to protect the environment.
When Queen Elizabeth delivered that speech to Parliament in 2006, climate change was emerging as a big issue in the UK. But the country had a problem. To really cut its carbon pollution, it would have to do something unthinkable a generation before. It would have to not only stop mining coal, but stop burning it, too.
The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler in Yorkshire, England.
So there are some similarities between Appalachia and the United Kingdom. A camaraderie between coal miners exists there as well as here, and some in Great Britain wonder if that cultural identity will disappear completely as coal mining jobs are no longer a part of the country's economic future. We'll hear more about the coal mining strike of the 1980s and its impact on coal mining communities in Wales. But next, Carolyn Beeler looks at how environmental policies in the past couple of years have made an even bigger impact on Britain's war on coal.
Great Britain was built on coal, quite literally.
Coal fueled the Industrial Revolution of Great Britain and put us where we are on the map.
Sean McLaughlin is a former miner. Now he works at the National Coal Mining Museum in Yorkshire.
It is ironic, yes.
McLaughlin's career arc pretty much tracks the fate of coal itself in the UK. Over the 40 years he spent in the industry, it went from being a central part of the UK's economy to a relic of the past. The sharp turn away from coal started in the 1980s with a strike that pitted miners and Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher against each other.
There was a sense before the strike of the industry being so important.
David Murray spent decades in the mines.
And I just think the industry lost that importance politically, economically, and everything.
Within a decade of that failed strike, the number of coal miners in the UK had fallen by 95%. The country was still burning a lot of coal, but more and more of it was being imported. And the decline of its domestic mining industry set the stage for an even more radical turn in the UK 30 years later.
It cannot be satisfactory for an advanced economy like the UK to be relying on polluting, carbon-intensive, 50-year-old coal-fired power stations.
That's former Energy Secretary Amber Rudd in 2015, announcing the UK would stop burning coal for electricity within a decade. It was a shift that few could have seen coming in the 80s. But lawmaker and environmental activist Bryony Worthington says the country's priorities were evolving.
I think the turn of the millennium, there was a real sea change in attitude towards climate change. It started to get political attention in a way that it hadn't.
By the mid-2000s, the UK was trying to cut its greenhouse gas emissions. But it was struggling to do that, in part because the country still got about a third of its electricity from coal. Worthington was working at an environmental nonprofit at the time, and she helped craft a bill that would legally require the UK to cut its carbon emissions.
It introduced 5-year carbon budgets, and most importantly, it set some clear deadlines.
Now, around the same time Worthington was proposing this, climate change was also a growing concern in the US. But there, it was a political football. Coal companies still had outsized influence and employed 20 times more workers than in the UK. Fossil fuel companies were spending record amounts lobbying Congress as it considered climate legislation. So looking from the U.S., it seems astonishing how easily the climate change law passed in the U.K. Bryony Worthington says there was no real opposition from coal interests.
That was not the main problem.
Even petroleum giants Shell and BP had been lobbying for climate legislation.
There were not the same level of climate skeptics that we see today. We didn't have that very well-resourced, very highly organized opposition.
The UK's Climate Change Act became law in 2008. It mandated an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by mid-century, and it laid out a clear timetable.
So you have this legal metronome now that the government can't get out of.
The law was the most sweeping of its kind in the world. It set the stage for a carbon tax that went into effect a few years later that made coal more expensive than natural gas. And when that happened, University of Sheffield researcher Grant Wilson says it's like someone flipped a switch.
I think one of the things that really has taken many people by surprise, myself included, was just simply the rate of that change, the tipping point.
Underused natural gas plants revved up and coal plants were switched off. Renewables soared. And in just a few years, coal dropped from supplying more than 40% of the UK's electricity to just 7%.
For any modern industrial economy to change a third of its electricity supply in a six-year period, it is really astonishing.
In late 2015, a month after the UK announced it would soon stop burning coal entirely, the country's last deep mine closed.
The last men from the last shift, from the last deep mine colliery, leave this place for good.
It was Kellingley Mine, where third-generation miner Sean McLaughlin started his career in 1977 as an apprentice and ended it decades later as the mine's manager.
We were the last miners. So yes, it was very emotional. There were lots of tears on site, saying goodbye to a lot of colleagues that I'd worked a long time with. So a very sad day, really.
McLaughlin takes me to Kellingley one morning, and it's quiet enough to hear birds chirping in the parking lot. He remembers what it was like during the boom years, when he'd have to jockey for a parking spot when shifts changed.
You look at it now, there's maybe 6 or 7 vehicles on this car park belonging to the demolition people. So it's really sad to look at this great industrial site as a state of demolition at the present time.
The mine itself is plugged with concrete.
And the pile of rubble just to the right-hand side, that's where my office used to be.
Earlier this year, the government laid out the final details of its plan to phase out coal by 2025. In the big picture, that's good for all of us. Burning coal is one of the biggest causes of climate change. But in the short term, it's not so good for people in coal regions, who still have lower than average employment rates and wages. And McLaughlin, for one, doesn't think the pain is worth it.
I'm a bit of a skeptic on this one. I think the small amount of coal that the UK burns isn't going to make much difference to the climate change.
He thinks the government is turning its back on people like him. He made a good living in the mines. It launched him out of public housing and gave his family a comfortable life.
I look at what a really good living it's provided me with. And I see my youngest son now is a school teacher. They do struggle. So, you know, I really feel sorry for young families of today wanting to bring a family into the world.
You hear this sentiment a lot in coal country in the U.S., but McLaughlin seems to be in the minority, even here in Yorkshire. Even as the power plants that were built on top of the coal fields start closing, many people around here don't seem too concerned because they don't see coal as the present. They see it as history.
I was born at the right time and got out at the right time.
Guys like Robin Heath and a couple of friends who I met at a coffee shop in the village of Eggbro. It's right in the shadow of a coal-fired power plant that's closing this fall.
Well, I think it's inevitable, isn't it? You know, it's been on its way out for years. It's a shame. But it's time moves on, doesn't it? You know?
You seem very matter-of-fact about that. Is everyone sort of of the same opinion?
The same. Just the same, really.
This is surprising to me, because all these guys work or used to work in the industry. Here's Dave Wiles.
I think it's inevitable, like Robin says. I think coal has had its day. If you believe all the scientists and experts on the damage it's doing, which I think there's enough evidence there now to support it, I think we are going the right way.
At the coal museum where Sean McLaughlin works now, a group of kids spills off the bus and heads to an old mine on site. It's likely the first time any of them will see a lump of coal in person. And in the country where King Coal was born, it may well be the last. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Yorkshire, England.
Next, we'll go from northern England to southern Wales, where former mining communities in Wales had to learn to diversify their economy after coal mines shut down 30 years ago. We aired a story several years ago from our friends at WMMT in eastern Kentucky as part of an ongoing media project they're doing called After Coal. We find out more about the transition in Wales in this 2014 report by Sylvia Ryerson.
What happens when fossil fuels run out? And how do rural communities reinvent themselves as natural resources are depleted? These are the big questions being asked right now by Tom Hansel and Patricia Beaver of Appalachian State University. And they are looking to former mining regions in South Wales to learn more and to support communities asking the same questions here in the coalfields of central Appalachia. According to Hansel, the similarities between the two regions are profound.
Well, I think the first parallel is the landscape. The Wales is mountainous. There's tight valleys, a lot like the hollers in eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia. There's also a strong union history there, and the transition from a more of a pastoral or agricultural economy to an industrial economy happened just as dramatically in Wales as it did in Appalachia.
And the rapid decline of coal industry jobs is tragically similar in both regions as well. The mines in Wales shut down almost entirely in the 1980s, and more than 85,000 miners lost their jobs. In Appalachia, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, over 70,000 mining jobs were lost between 1980 and 2000, and a June 2012 EIA report projects that Appalachian coal production will be cut in half this decade. But while the layoffs in Wales happened almost overnight, in a matter of just 4 or 5 years, in Appalachia, the jobs have been slowly disappearing over decades. Hansel has done extensive research and interviews for his upcoming documentary film, After Coal, in the South Wales community's hardest hit by the mine closures.
And from talking to them and reading their accounts, it sounds like things felt apocalyptic. That besides the mines being shut down, there were schools being shut down, doctors' offices leaving, and that people really were questioning what sort of future they had.
Dr. Hal Francis is the Labour Party Member of Parliament for Aberavon, Wales, and has been a longtime collaborator on the After Coal project. And as he recalls the decade of the layoffs...
Everyone somehow or other in Wales feels as if they have their roots in coal. Communities always change. Industries come and go. And it was foolish of us to think at the end of the 85 strike that it was the end of the world. It was an opportunity for a new beginning. And we should never have really have been so committed to sustaining communities on the back of an appalling industry like coal.
And of course, what we've seen since then through the 1990s and the 2000s, that Welsh communities have regrouped. They have survived. They've gone through some tough times. But the first thing they did was did a lot of environmental reclamation. And so cleaning up acid mine drainage, mine waste piles, all those sorts of things was kind of the foundation of their regeneration, is what they call it. And then the second thing that they did was invested in education. And then the third thing that they've done is looked at a variety of forms of renewable energy. One huge difference in the mines in Wales with the mines in Appalachia is that they were government-owned. They were nationalized. So when the mines were shut down, the government provided severance funds to the miners that helped with economic transition. And in a lot of cases, the government turned over coal mining facilities, offices even, to community groups.
One example of this is the Dove Workshop, an adult education center located in the offices of a former strip mine in the village of Benwen at the head of the Dulles Valley. Founded by miners' wives and working in collaboration with the Welsh University System, the center was established to provide part-time course enrollment, free childcare, and transportation for all students. As co-founder Meyer Francis recalls, the founding of Dove also reflects how gender roles changed during this time, as women took the lead in rebuilding their communities.
When we set up Dove during the miners' strike, we wanted to have an opportunity for women to be involved in something that they were the decision makers, that they decided how things should be run and how things should be developed.
The main aim of the organisation is to offer education and training to adults from 16 years up so that they can take courses in their own community, from return to learn, art classes, craft classes, all the way through to a part-time degree in humanities, which is offered by Swansea University.
Well, I started off as somebody who'd never typed anything,
who, you know, didn't have any skills in learning in any shape or form, but I've avid belief in what learning can do for somebody, and I'm loving it myself. I did the degree here, the BA Humanities, and I think it was 2 or 3 years ago I finished my Master's in Lifelong Learning.
Those were the voices of Meyer Francis, Julie Bibby, and Leslie Smith of the Dove Workshop. 3 decades later, classes are still going strong, and the Dove Building now hosts several small-scale entrepreneurs, including a daycare, library, a community garden, and a cafe featuring local foods. And while Wales is still far from having all the answers, Hansel and his colleagues believe the Dove Workshop is just one example among many we can learn from here in Appalachia. In addition to investing in education in the rural former mining communities, prioritizing environmental restoration projects and sustaining local cultural traditions were key to the transition in South Wales.
Having a clean environment is a key to having a clean economy. And so that often involves government effort, and in order for those that government efforts to actually be effective and not be corrupt or pork barrel projects, local people really need to be involved in their government. And so that's kind of a role for grassroots organizing. It shows how important grassroots organizing is in this kind of economic transition, economic renewal. And then I think the other thing is that culture helps communities survive. I mean, each of these communities we went to, although the mines had closed down, there were still miners' choirs. There were union halls where people went to gather that often had been turned into cultural centers where people, they had art galleries and movie theaters and farmers markets there. So culture is another kind of key to community survival.
Leslie Smith realized through the Dove Workshop just how much all of these areas overlap.
When Dove was established, it was very much in the style of a lifelong learning center, and we still call that by a lot of people. But we came to recognize that the work that we were doing was helping the economy, helping to regenerate a community. Our geography doesn't lend itself very well to inward investment. I don't think, you're not going to build a factory up the road because you haven't got the infrastructure, you haven't got the rail systems. We need people to be more entrepreneurial, because when you get people to run a little business in a community, they're not going to get up and walk away when the going gets tough. It's not always about making a lot of money for one person, but it's about making a living, which is a completely different thing, I think, People say to me all the time, yeah, but what's in the Dulles Valley? Well, I don't know what it is, but there's a sort of community here.
If the going gets tough, we all get together. And I think it was proved during the miners' strike. We've got a lot to show and a lot to be proud of. Not to forget our roots, our mining, where we've all come from, but build on that.
Again, that was Leslie Smith and Julie Bibby of the Dove Workshop. That story was produced by Sylvia Ryerson for WMMT in 2014. The documentary project she mentioned after Cole is still going on. Appleshop filmmaker Tom Hansel published a book about the project in November of 2018. We'll keep you updated on that and more from the After Cole project. We've posted a link on our website where you can learn more. That's at wvpublic.org. By the way, the Inside Appalachia team is planning a reporting trip to Wales and other parts of the United Kingdom next year. Do you have a connection to a coal mining community in the UK? Do you have a recommendation for somewhere special off the beaten path that you think we should visit or someone we should interview while we're there? Send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or send us a tweet at @InAppalachia. After the break, we'll explore how music from Scotland made its way to Appalachia and influenced folk music in our mountains. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
On this show, we've been crossing the Atlantic to learn more about cultural and economic similarities and differences. Now we're going back to one of our favorite interviews from the Inside Appalachia Archives. Back in 2014, former Inside Appalachia host Beth Voorhees spoke with popular music show host Fiona Ritchie about a book she co-authored, which tells the story of the music migration from Scotland and Ireland to Appalachia. It's called Wayfaring Strangers, The Music Voyage from Scotland and Ulster to Appalachia. It also comes with a CD of traditional music. Ritchie wrote the book and produced the CD, along with noted musician and president emeritus of Warren Wilson College, Doug Orr. Let's listen back to their conversation.
Why did you want to write this book?
We needed to write this book. This book, actually, I don't think we can pick the starting point when we decided we were going to write this book, but it really is the outcome of decades of conversations between myself and my co-author Doug here, which basically mirrored our own discoveries in the music. I had moved from Scotland over to North Carolina, very quickly realised I was in the heartland of some fantastic music, also realising very quickly that it was connected to music from where I was from. So I went on a little personal journey of discovery way before you could research these things on the internet to find out all about what this connection was all about. Meanwhile, Doug, before I'd even met him, was very interested in researching the roots of his own family tree, his family originally having come from Scotland on the Scots-Irish migration that we've written about. So when we became friends through a large community of musicians and like-minded souls in Charlotte, North Carolina, we found that we were on these kind of opposite tracks, and we found a lot of great things to chat about. And so about a decade ago, we finally decided that we really needed to somehow work on this together and write a book. So it's taken that long for us to get to the point where we're holding Wayfaring Strangers in our hands, but it is the result of many transatlantic conversations and quite a few, I might say, also around pub tables and fireplaces.
It was a natural progression because many of Fiona's Cicely and Shamrock shows have featured the Atlantic Bridge, our hands across the water, making connections. Meanwhile, we were performing music in a band in Charlotte, the theme of which was the connection, doing music of the Appalachian and music of the Celtic lands. We visited West Virginia many times to music camps, making the same connections there. So it just came naturally, and it was certainly a labor of love.
One of the things we tried to do with the CD was to show the Scottish version or the Irish version of the song, and then we could hear how it sounded when it crossed over. And a great example of that is the song Gypsy Davy. It originated as Gypsy Laddies in Scotland. It went to Ireland where it became Raggle Taggle Gypsy, and then it travelled over to the United States where it became Gypsy Davy. Some of the elements of the song changed. It lost some of its supernatural story that was in the original Scottish version. It lost all its very dense Scots dialect, and it became an Appalachian song. And we have Julie and Mark here from Little Windows, and maybe they'd like to sing a bit of Gypsy Davy for us.
Please.
Actually, Julie, can you sing the first verse of the Scots version, which is the Gypsy Laddie? And we know that you're not Scottish and you'll do your best. And then and then go into the Appalachian song.
Great. Oh, the gypsies came to our hall door. They came and they sang bonny o. They sang say sweet and they say complete, and they stole the heart of our lady o. Go fetch for me my little white mare, speediest one of any. And I'll go down to the maple swamp, see if I can overtake her. Straddle-a-lady, lady, lady, straddle-a-lady, lady. Straddle-a-lady, pretty all day, gone with the gypsy davy. So I went down to the maple swamp, looked so black and gaily. Yes, I went down to the maple swamp, there I spied my baby. Straddle-a-lady, lady, lady, straddle-a-lady, lady. Straddle-a-lady, and a litty pretty all day, gone with the gypsy day me.
Beth, that's Gypsy Davy, sung by Julie Glad Weems with Mark Weems, and that's also on the CD, and it's one of my favourites on the CD because it helps to illustrate the journey of the song, starting with the Jack Beck song on the CD and going into Julie Glaub's version of Gypsy Davy. And that song really, if you were to pick one song, that one probably traces out the music migration almost as well as any.
And we need to remember in the music migration, Beth, that this was the oral tradition carried on from generation to generation, family to family. So a family might have been sitting on a front porch in the Allegheny Mountains of West Virginia and trying to recall the words, adding some words themselves. This was the organic process. So when Cecil Sharp came to our Southern Appalachians in 1916 to start collecting, he eventually found about 197 variants of Barbara Allen, for example, because it was a living thing and families interpreted, names changed. It simply enriched the family tree, or what the great Scottish folklorists call the caring stream mm-hmm. of the music.
Mm-hmm. As I was reading your book, Wayfaring Strangers, it occurred to me that here in Appalachia, we are very aware of our ties to Scotland and Ireland. Over there, are people aware of their ties to us?
I would say only recently. When I lived over here in North Carolina, I became very interested in those connections, but it was all news to me. You know, when people are living in a country, you're aware of your own history in that country. You know where people have come from and what they've done. But after people leave, it becomes vague. You don't really follow their story. So when I went back over to Scotland and I was doing work on BBC Radio Scotland, I just became really keen on sort of illustrating that. And so I sort of did the Thistle and Shamrock in reverse and started playing lots of American music to try and illustrate the connection. And it wasn't something people were that aware of. Media has changed all that. And people are now able to explore online where music comes from.
We're listening to an interview former Inside Appalachia host Beth Voorhees recorded back in 2014 with Fiona Ritchie and Doug Orr about their book, Wayfaring Strangers, The Music Voyage from Scotland and Ulster to Appalachia. Ritchie was recently awarded an MBE, becoming a member of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, as the founder, producer, and host of NPR's The Thistle and Shamrock. Let's get back to Beth's conversation with Fiona Ritchie.
I'd like to kind of stray from the music a little bit. And Fiona, if you would, in Wayfaring Strangers, you have an interview here with Alan Reid, a Scottish songwriter, singer, and keyboard player interviewed in Scotland in March 2013. And he has what I think is a very interesting description of the people who came from Scotland and Ireland to Appalachia. Could you share that paragraph with us?
Yes, I'm happy to do so. Alan played for many years with the band Battlefield Band and toured all around the United States and in through West Virginia many times. And he developed a real sense of the connections that there were between these places and how the music had travelled as they themselves in our time took the music around the world. And Alan wrote as part of, well, Alan spoke to me in the interview and I wrote down what he said. And part of what Alan said was, although I think it's really interesting, this has always struck me that the Scots in particular have been much less clannish than, say, the Irish or the Italians in migrating and setting up their own wee areas, their own parts of cities. The Scots, it seems to me, have been actually more independent and kind of disappeared into the woodwork. And maybe in places like Appalachia, it was quite natural to go up the valley, build your cabin and have your family and hardly see anybody else, which could be good and bad. The idea of not having a support, a big support network that other nationalities seem to have. We have this image of the independent, self-supporting, pioneering Scot that, you know, I guess would build his cabin and set up the fence for the borders of his territory, of his property, and then defend it against all comers. So they would make great pioneers, you know, pushing that frontier forward. I'm not saying it was just them, but they were, I wouldn't say the elite, but willing, desperate, stubborn, aggressive enough.
Why that struck me is because up until then I hadn't thought about it, but in urban areas you had Little Italy, you had the Irish section, Germantown, Chinatown. I don't think in any urban cities we have Scots-Irish town.
No.
No.
Or indeed Scottish town with the Highland Scots either. They tended to spread out. I mean, you did have areas where, say, for example, in eastern North Carolina, where you had Highland Scots who came over after the Jacobite risings and settled in the Cape Fear River area. But even then, they didn't really form a clannish, tight-knit society. They spread out and eventually were moved on when they created the Fort Bragg military reservation. So whatever vestige there was of them was eventually moved on anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, an important part of this story is when the Scotch-Irish made their way down the Great Philadelphia Wagon Road through the Shenandoah into the southern Appalachians. And unlike the Germans, as you say, who tended to cluster, or the English or others, they dispersed. Now, they did adapt and borrow along the way. They borrowed the German Scheitholt instrument and turned it into the Appalachian dulcimer. They borrowed the long rifle. They borrowed the log cabin design. But they were seeking independence and wound up in the coves and hollows of the southern Appalachians, where the old saying was, you had to lie down and look up to see out. Isolated, although their other influences occurred. But yes, that was a much different story. They would settle along the way, perhaps in Virginia, in farmsteads and clear land, on into the Carolinas, and dispersed. And the old saying was, if you could see the smokestack from a neighbor within 5 miles, it was too close and you moved on.
Well, how did
that? I think
that...
also, Beth, sorry, I was just going to say, Beth, I think also that they'd been moved already. They'd transported themselves to plantation schemes in Ulster. Things hadn't worked out. There was rent racking. Their church that they had adhered to, the Presbyterian Church, became not the official church of the Ulster area. They then moved on to Pennsylvania, where they weren't able to settle because land wasn't necessarily available, and so they started to migrate south. And I think they had learned not to rely on other people. They didn't feel that there was anyone necessarily looking out for them or their interests, so they had to look out for themselves.
Mm-hmm. How did this idea of moving away, becoming isolated, building your cabin, raising your family, how did that affect the music?
Well, there's an interesting dynamic that runs through the music in the story of the migration, Beth, and that is a sense of wanderlust. They were always looking over the next horizon to Canaan's land, which was in the music in Ulster, for a better life, because they did suffer rent racking, religious discrimination, but also a great sense of place and homesickness. So up to the time they settled in the southern Appalachians, there was somewhat of a longing for the old place, great sense of place, but also venturing into a new land. And consequently, that made its way into the music. For example, there are probably more songs of farewell in the Scottish and Irish tradition than perhaps any in the entire world, be it Jamie Rayburn's Farewell in Scotland, or Farewell to Whiskey, or Farewell to Enniskillen, or Campbell's Farewell to Ireland. They were always saying goodbye, American wakes, saying goodbye to the next generation. So it was a people on the move, and thankfully that dynamic worked its way into beautiful music, be it ballads, stories, or fiddle tunes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a farewell song that you can share with us?
Oh, of all the money that e'er I had, I spent it in good company, and of all the harm that e'er I've done, alas, it was to none but me. For all I've done, for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass. Good night and joy be with you all.
Let me make the comment about parting glass. It's very old, older than Auld Lang Syne, and traces back to, not only to Ireland, but before that to Scotland. And as immigrants were on the move, came into the port of Philadelphia, they would have a parting glass in the local inn or tavern, never to see one another again. same thing when they left Ulster. So it's a wonderful, beautiful, poignant song of separation.
And the sense of connection with the songs is beautifully summed up, the importance of the songs, by a quote from Jean Ritchie from her book Singing Family of the Cumberlands, where she wrote, "The old songs were in our heads and hearts like breathing and were handed down through the generations in a living tradition as if they'd been carried along in a migration stream from across the sea." So it included songs like The Parting Glass.
Fiona Ritchie and Doug Orr. The book is Wayfaring Strangers, The Musical Voyage from Scotland and Ulster to Appalachia. An absolutely excellent book. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Go fetch for me my little white mare, speediest one of any, and I'll go down to the maple swamp, see if I can overtake her, straddle at a leaf.
As we just heard, traveling across the globe doesn't always yield an entirely new culture or identity. The coal industry in parts of Appalachia has been disappearing for years. As the jobs go away, so go entire towns that were literally built by coal companies. The people from these towns, including myself, have a bond unmatched and uncomparable to other places. As the world transitions to digital rooms and chat groups, the coal camps are places where the people still get excited about community. So, yeah, it's sad to see some of the towns fade away. But as we also heard from Fiona Ritchie, the Scots-Irish roots of the region remain a part of the cultural identity in this area. Even though they traveled across the ocean, they still held on to a part of their identity. There's a certain level of toughness that comes with being a coal miner or living in coal country. I'll admit, I identify deeply with my strong mining neighbors. So it gives me hope that no matter where you go, the legacy of your family and community inevitably lives on in your future, even if you can't see it. It seems like we're in a different phase in our use and connection to coal than folks in Wales. So I wonder, what part of their coal heritage or identity has remained as the coal jobs there went away? Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, the Ohio Valley Resource, and PRI's The World. Music in today's show was compiled by Fiona Ritchie from her book and CD, Wayfaring Strangers, The Musical Voyage from Scotland and Ulster to Appalachia. Music was also provided by Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also email us at InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.